it, and it comes from my wife's grandfather from Norway. He was a German in the occupation of the Germans in Norway in World War II. He would catch a fish, put it in his backpack, go up the mountains, and trade the fish for a gallon of milk from a farmer, and come back with a gallon of milk. I see money as a way to put that fish in your pocket and store it until next week, until you can exchange it for something else. It's just an agreed-upon tool that we use to get that job done. And we can play all kinds of games with it, and they all work. I mean, it's all sorts of things that really happen. I'm going to let it drop for 1 second to finish up. But at its base, it's a societal tool, like a word. If I say that's a bird, we all understand it's a bird. You have a fish worth of monetary value in your pocket. Granted, it's grossly simplified from what most of you guys are thinking about. But if that's not true, the rest of it's all BS. Sorry, that's my thought. I'm done for now. Thanks, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, civilization has gone from barter, and your story about the fish is a perfect example of barter. Then some clever king about 2,500 years ago, I think, minted coins. So the commodity of the coin, the agreed-upon value of the coin, just because we think that gold is worth something an ounce is not intrinsic to the gold. It is something of the value that we've all agreed upon. So it was an agreed upon. It was a currency. Was actually the agreed upon commodity. Then it became a fiat currency where it's backed by the goodwill of the country. So yeah, ultimately, currency is a a simplified way of exchanging goods with each other based upon a currency that the society agrees mutually on to establish a price that's subject to change over time.
Okay, G2RY. All agree on what that is. It's so clouded in mystery. That's, I think, the heart of what we're dealing with these days. The nuances aside, that's the heart of the matter.
Well, yeah, and a lot of people will somewhat speciously say that currency is just an illusion. I guess it's an agreed-upon illusion, but at least with a fiat currency, you theoretically have the goodwill of a nation-state. With cryptocurrency, you got a bunch of guys basically in sneakers, hunched over their laptop, typing away that I don't know who the hell they are. So I don't know. I certainly don't trust governments much. Maybe I'm a crypto anarchist at heart, but I trust them more than guys who hack computers in general.
Agree and thank you. Over.
Okay, very good. David, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I want to say something. In terms of technology, what are the major differences between currency that you can hold in your hand and currency that's on your computer, digital currency? Because at one point in time, there wasn't computers for digital currency. So going from those days till now, how do we know that people aren't generating currency on the digital end?
Well, currently, money is, even digital money, is regulated, and it is centralized. There's a lot of regulatory agencies. There's a lot of looking at into what people and banks are doing, and banking and currency and the Fed and all are centralized means of exchange of electronic funds, whereas cryptocurrency is supposed to be a decentralized one that's not connected to regulatory agencies whatsoever. So it's a little bit more difficult to commit heavy-duty bank fraud. There's more money in it, most likely, incredibly more. But I think it's more difficult because of the centralization and regulations kind of tying it all up.
QSL. But I guess technologically, how does a coin measure up to a digital file or some digital bits and bytes?
Well, in the case of American dollar currency, your electronic fund transfer is locked into the value of a dollar bill. So a dollar bill electronically and a dollar bill in your wallet is worth the same exact amount. And it's kind of locked in as that. It's considered the same as your paper or coin currency. It just exists on data streams and hard drives in regulated, centralized servers throughout the world.
Roy, can D2FI you real quick?
Yeah, sure, George.
Yes, the value of the strength of the country that is providing the strength of the economy throughout the world. That's what I see the dollar as.
Well, yes. Again, it's the fact that we're the wealthiest country and we have a relatively strong economy and a strong country, and so the country is not going to be overthrown by Canada anytime soon, and it's not going to go bankrupt anytime soon. So it's a dependable currency that the world has used for a long time and hopefully will continue to use as kind of an international currency of exchange. But if we didn't have those aspects, then people would pick a different currency. AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, and we have a few more minutes. If someone has another question or topic or anything, please feel free to hit the push-to-talk button. Yes, Rich. Do you see what your question provoked? Well, I certainly hope so. I can't really hear everything you say, so I'm sort of attempting to interpret it. I think you mentioned a debit card that's kind of hooked into your cryptocurrency wallet. And you have the same problems. You only really can do seven transfers per second in the entire world. And so ultimately, if you have people using it as a debit card, I would think that would require a great deal more operations per second. You'd clog the system up, and it would kind of make a mess of everything. And when you have a very, very high latency, it increases the risks of dropping transactions. So some of your debit transactions might just disappear into nothingness. So, again, I don't think it would be a good debit card either. I appreciate the technology behind it and considering the different aspects of it. I just think that the implementations are problematic, and I think way too many people are going to lose way too much money when this whirligig ends.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Okay, next week we'll start off with the word value. the relationship of what you give for what you get. Just put it on the lighter side, Roy. Thank you for bringing me in tonight, 73KD2FIU.
AFTP, Ed, with a question not related to crypto.
Yes, Ed. Can I have your call sign again? Okay, your signal broke up a lot. I couldn't make out any of that.
Roy, did you hear me?
Somebody's putting courier on him.
Oh, that's a nasty thing to do. George, I heard you. I appreciate it. What can I tell you? I mean, you could bring it up for the economy net at 12:06, but, you know, value. That certainly is economy 101.
Thank you, Roy. 73KD2FIU clear.
AF2P.
Very good, Ed. Please, what's your question for tonight?
Am I allowed to hear something that has nothing to do with cryptocurrency?
Matter of fact, I would appreciate it if you did just that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm having trouble with Thunderbird, and I wonder if anybody on the frequency is having trouble with Thunderbird, or if there's any advice about where I can go to get some counseling on how to get the damn thing working again.
I would assume by Thunderbird you're talking about the email client.
Exactly right. You're exactly right, Roy.
Okay. Unfortunately, I have had very little experience. I use a web server email for my main domain. I have Microsoft Outlook, which is not terribly good. So I have not used Thunderbird much. Well, what particular problem are you having with it, or is it just a generic problem?
Well, after the last automatic download of the update for it, I ceased to be able to use the email in Thunderbird. Now, that email is linked through AOL. It's actually AOL Mail, but it then wears the Verizon brand name because of Thunderbird. And if I go to the AOL account, everything works fine. But the linkage between the Thunderbird and the AOL is somehow screwed up.
Okay. Is that an executable window, or is that an overlay on a browser?
Okay, you've asked a question that requires more technical knowledge than I have. I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between those things. I know I did find advice about here's what you do, all these steps which I followed, and they did nothing for me. But as to whether it's an overlay or an executable of its own, I don't know.
WB2 DCU.
Yes.
I think I can help you with that. That's a problem. It is actually something that is between Verizon and AOL. Of course, they both blame each other, but I was able to fix that with some guidance from AOL. Go ahead.
Okay, how do I contact AOL to get this guidance? Is it stuff that's written up? Because I've actually gone through what I was able to read and gotten nowhere. Going to need someone to say, oh no, you dummy, you're doing this thing wrong.
Okay, the thing to do would be to call Verizon and get their technical support people, IT technical support people on the line, and explain to them what the problem is. What's happening is that when Verizon attempts to hand off a password to AOL, everything goes down the pipe. Essentially, AOL has changed their password structure, supposedly to tighten up security, but to make a long story short, call Verizon and ask them for the AOL email technical support number. They will give that to you, and then call them, and they'll talk you through how you got to go about it. You actually have to go online and get a temporary password that they will give you that will allow Thunderbird to talk from Verizon to AOL and back again.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much. I was hoping I'd get an answer, and here's the place, and boy, oh boy, that's great. Thank you. Roy, I'll turn it back to you, AF2P.
Okay, very good, Ed. I'm glad you got an answer. W2GCU, what's your first name?
Call sign is WB2GCU, Whiskey Bravo 2, Delta Charlie United. And my name is John, Juliet Oscar, Hotel November.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John. Thank you very much for helping Ed out.
Well, he's not through it yet. I will tell you that the process is not a very pleasant one. I had a lot of difficulty with an accent, but once you get the hang of what they're telling you what to do, it's a chip shot. And then once it's done, it's done forever. But getting there is the trick. But bear with it. They'll get you through it.
Okay, very good. I hope Ed all the luck of the world. I have never been a big fan of calling technical support. I do it as infrequently as humanly possible. And unfortunately, I find that I figure out how to fix things while I'm on the phone with them, wasting my time more often than the other way around. But hopefully they've had to deal with it before, so hopefully they know how to deal with it now. So thanks to you, John. This is AC2GS. It is 10:18. Let me just quickly tell you the links. If you want to email me, you can't get me on the radio, then my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's for mailbag questions, for topics of discussions, to offer me some technical puzzles, to offer to the rest of you guys, or to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to read or see some website or YouTube that's NASA or space-related. Of course, you could email him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Then there is the link page with all kinds of interesting pages. There's some stuff on NFTs if you haven't had enough of that. That's available at just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. Then there's the audio stream. If you want to listen on the internet to Glen Oaks, it's type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as I always like to remind people, MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site of technical nets going as far back as September 2006. That's amateurradio.tv. Over a million visitors, so please make it 1,000,001. So I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Not a lot of discussion of amateur radio, but a lot of discussion. So I hope everyone found it enjoyable. And now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
Okay, AT2GS WS2N, very good, Roy. And by the way, it's a good movie called the Hummingbird Project. And, you know, I mean, it's not a great movie, but it has that whole theory between two different
competing ways of getting a signal from the middle of the country to the stock exchange. You know, one is fiber optics and the other one is RF. And the whole story about these guys that want to build a fiber optics with, it's supposed to be, they want to make it where it's faster than RF. Good story, anyway. It's, you know. I'm just looking at the my list here for a couple of topics, and there aren't all that many different things happening in the space program with NASA. I think the next big thing, of course, is going to be the Artemis program. Of course, the telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, that's really the main deal for the last couple of months. But they also do aeronautics, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And, you know, they do have these airplanes that they're always involved with. And there's two of them that they use for going through storms. There's the ER-2, they call it, the high-altitude jet. And then there's the P-3, the turboprop. The E-2 flies above the storms, and the other one flies right through them. And that's what they did with this blizzard, this snowstorm that came up the East Coast. They do this every time. And, of course, they gather information to actually support the weather forecast. But the main thing is to gather information for scientific testing, you know, for scientific information so that they don't have to, they can figure out what, you know, how these storms develop and details that they don't normally get. You have satellites that are looking down at these storms, getting information. So they have much more detail if you take a plane and fly it at 45,000 feet. You know, the ER-2 that does that just has one pilot in there for all kinds of test equipment. And then you have the other one, which you could put like 20 people on board that one, that turboprop, and that's the one that flies right through the storms. They test everything from the size of the particles of the snow, you know, the naturally wind, and they bring that data back, and it helps them for future predictions of how bad a storm is going to be. So I thought I'd bring that up. The P-3 flies out of Wallops, you know, Virginia, and, which I talk about Wallops a lot. That's a launch complex that we have in Virginia that NASA uses all the time for the spacecraft to be launched to the space station or sounding rockets, and then the other plane comes out of the Carolinas. So I thought I'd bring that up. Let me drop it. Okay. The next thing I was going to mention is the story I heard quite a few times on regular news, you know, which I thought was unusual to find any space-related news that, you know, that's of any import. It's very unusual lately for me. You know, I watch CNN and it's nothing but politics. But anyway, they mentioned the Falcon 9 second stage that was launched years ago, about a half dozen years ago. They launched a mission that we covered here on the net called the Deep Space Climate Observatory. The short name for it was Discover. And that was launched to the L1 position. You know, you have five Lagrange points, L1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. L2 we've been talking about lately, that's the one that's 1 million miles further away from the Earth, further away from the Sun than the Earth, and then the L1 is 1 million miles closer to the Sun than the Earth, and that's where this one went, you know, 6 years ago. And it started out probably 10 years before that. They had a name for it called the Triana, and they mothballed that for many, many years. And then time went on. It basically had to do with politics, because this was, you know, dealing with climate control, problems, and global warming and all. But anyway, they finally got around to launching this, and they called it the Discover Deep Space Climate Observatory, and SpaceX launched it and sent it out to this 1 million mile location away from Earth called L1, and everything worked great. I mean, it's just a replica. In fact, you can go to the website, you can look at pictures, live pictures of the Earth, with maybe the moon going around the Earth, you know, from what it looks like four times the distance away from, you know, from us and the moon. Anyway, they had a Falcon 9 that launched this rocket, and they had a second stage that pushed the Discover into that location. And then that stage wound up, you know, actually orbiting the moon and the Earth, going around it over and over again. It didn't go into a heliocentric orbit, and that's where it stayed. But because of, you know, orbital mechanics, and there's no fuel on board to change any orbital parameters, eventually this thing will now hit the moon. And it looks like it's going to hit the dark side of the moon, or the far side of the moon. Like, it's in constant orbit, so this time the stage is actually coming back toward Earth, so it will be probably hitting the moon early March. We'll see what happens. There are two spacecraft orbiting the moon right now. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, you know, by NASA, and there's another one, Chandrayaan, which is by India, that's still active. And if they time it right, they'll be able to see the possible impact on the far side of the moon when that does happen, with maybe one or both of those satellites. Should be interesting. They've done that kind of thing before. Back in 2009, they had, you know, NASA purposely sent a second stage crashing into the moon. At about the same speed, this one's going to hit around 5,000 miles per hour. And it'll be hitting, and that was called the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. So, they had a camera, you know, in a stage following this thing. And then the first one, you know, the first stage that hit, the camera was able to take pictures of it and send it back to Deep Space Network. The idea was to look for signs of hydrogen atoms flying through the lunar, well, not atmosphere, but, you know, coming off the surface of the moon, see if they could detect hydrogen, which would be a sign of water molecules, which they detected. So I would imagine they'll try to do something similar if this thing crashes into the far side of the moon. So that's the story on that. You probably see it on the news. Those kind of stories always make it to the news. Anyway, any questions? This is WS2M. Nothing heard. James Webb Space Telescope, I mentioned before, has successfully gone into a halo orbit at the L2 position, 1 million miles away from the Earth, four times the distance of the moon, sitting out there in a very large diameter orbit, you know, up to 500,000 miles. So you know, it's in this orbit around this invisible spot called L2. It will orbit that one spot in 6 months. Every 6 months, it will go around and around. And the idea is to keep the backside of the spacecraft, which has the solar panels, you know, to supply power, always facing the Earth, facing the Sun. You don't want the Earth to get in the way. You don't want an eclipse situation. And that's the way they have it. And of course, the temperatures are high. It's right now, it's on their website. I think it's around 180 degrees Fahrenheit. But on the cold side of that, you know, you have five mylar layers of this stretched out, as big as a tennis court, grouping of blankets protecting the equipment and the telescope itself. On that side, it's down to minus 388 degrees. They want to go as low as possible. And eventually they'll achieve that. Everything has worked actually 100%. Right now they're in the calibration stage of realigning all the mirrors. All 18 mirrors have to be perfectly realigned. And that will take a couple more months. You know, they'll point to that one particular star. That light of the star will, in the beginning, will probably have like 18 little stars coming up on the CCD, the charge coupled device, and they'll send that information back, and they'll see 18 little spots. So they'll adjust this mirror, they'll adjust that mirror, all 18 mirrors, until eventually all those spots eventually wind up in one point. Once they get that, then they know they'll be in focus. So hopefully in a few months, maybe, I guess May, after doing all those mirrors, they'll make sure all the instruments are, working, calibrated. The four main instruments that will be taking pictures. And if that all works out, we'll get pictures probably, my guess is in May. Any questions on the James Webb Space Telescope? I think I left enough time for Echolink. Anyway. Okay, no questions. Mars Curiosity. Still riding around on Mars. 2012. I think it landed there in August 2012. So here we are, almost 10 years later. Oh, eight years later. Let's see. We'll come up to the 10-year anniversary. And now we have the other one, Perseverance, also riding around on Mars. Both nuclear-powered. All our solar panels, our rovers are not working anymore. From Sojourner back in the early mid-90s to the two solar panel rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. One worked for 6 years, the other one for 14 years. And here, Curiosity is now 10 years riding around on Mars. Perseverance, that will be... February 18th. Curiosity detected a certain carbon on the planet. And there's different variations of carbon. And this particular one is something that would only usually come from something that had life at one time. So they're investigating that. Of course, they'd love to have that come true. But there's other things that cause the caused this particular carbon to exist. They said ultraviolet light from the sun, a combination of that, a few other things could do that as well. So they look further into it, you never know. I mean, I don't think they're going to come up with a fossil or anything like that, but it's going to be interesting to see what they come up with. They'll really get good evidence once Perseverance, years from now, is able to send back core samples from its mission. So, you know, it should take about 30 or so core samples, and eventually will be launched back to Earth. And at that time, the scientists will really have a ball. They have machines and equipment that on Earth that you can't possibly send to Mars. They have very good, you know, pieces of equipment on Mars to do, you know, spectral analysis and, you know, all kinds of tests. They can tell you a lot of things, but they can tell you a lot more if they get these samples eventually back on Earth. We'll see. Any questions or comments? Nothing heard? Lucy, there's a mission called Lucy that was launched a while back. And, you know, it got into orbit. The idea is to eventually go to the L4 and the L5 locations of Jupiter. You know, just like you have the five different locations for Lagrange points for Sun, Earth, and then, you know, whatever that one point would be L2. You have the same five points when you're talking about any two objects like the Sun and Jupiter. And they're interested in sending this to L4 and L5. If you were to draw an equilateral triangle between the Sun and, you know, if you go forward in the forward direction of the travel of Jupiter, between that point and Jupiter itself, and then back to the Sun, that equilateral triangle, that point would be called L4. Now, if you did that one from the lagging position, you know, where Jupiter came from, and another triangle in that direction, that would be L5. The idea of Lucy, the Lucy mission, will be to go to L4 and then maybe many years later, another 5 years later, eventually it will go to the other L4, L5. It'll oscillate between that over many, many years. So, anyway, this mission, to be successful, you need power. Have power out by Jupiter. It's really not that easy. Years ago, the only answer was to send a radioisotope thermoelectric generator on these missions, like Galileo did. But as we got better with solar panels, and we were able to make bigger solar panels for Jupiter anyway, we don't need a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. We need big solar panels, and that's just what they did for Juno, which is still orbiting in a polar orbit around Jupiter. I think it's, 2013 it got there. Anyway, Jupiter has these panels that are about 120 feet long, and you know, because they're so long, they're able to put out enough wattage to supply the equipment. You know, if you were to take Juno and put it into Earth orbit, you know, you'd probably get, you know, 30,000 watts of power, but out in Jupiter orbit, you know, they're happy with 1,000 or 2 watts. Same thing with Lucy. Lucy has two massive panels that it needed to open to succeed in its mission in going to the L4 and L5 positions of Jupiter to look for these Trojan, they call them Trojan asteroids. They're going to be finding them and, passing a couple of them and not orbiting them, but they're up close to them and then leave and go going to go eventually to L5 and then back to L4. And so on, but to do all this, you need power. So they have these two massive solar panels that open up in a big circle, like a big dish. And the diameter is like 24 feet, just over 24 feet on each one. So it's like, it sounded large to me when I first heard this 224 diameter solar panels. But enough power to run the whole mission when you're all the way out to Jupiter. And one of the ways they do it is they have this cable through a series of pulleys, and it pulls this whole thing out and around.
It's like about
20 triangles. Anyway, it would eventually open up and curve around, and it's supposed to latch in to where it started to wind up with this big, big flat circular solar panel. It didn't. One of them went all the way and latched properly. The other one didn't. But it made it around. They gave the degrees. I think they were short by about 25 degrees or something. It didn't make it to the all the way around. Went to 180, kept going. They do it slow, and then eventually it's supposed to get to 360. It never got that far. Never latched on. And they figured out from the telemetry what probably happened is this cable that goes through a series of pulleys popped off a pulley. There was probably some slack, and it popped off and then wound up wrapping around the shaft of the motor. So by the sounds of that, it sounds like they're done, but they did say they're going to try to do something else. Not sure what they're going to do. There's no motor that could pull it back and go in the other direction and start all over again. And if this thing's all wrapped around the shaft, I think that, it's over. But fortunately, the panel itself is still producing power, and they figured out they're only losing about 10% of what they planned on. So they got 90% of the power for this mission that's going to go on for decades. So we'll see how good Lucy does. Anyway, any questions or comments? WS2R.
Question NQ1U.
NQ1U, I think you said, correct?
Yeah, thanks. November, Quebec, one uniform, name is John. I want to go back to James Webb for a minute, please. What do you know what the power would be to send data back to Earth?
Transmission power. Deep space space probes. Usually, I think they're in the 20 to 25 watt category when they start out. Is that the question?
Yes, it is. That's what I wanted to know. What sort of power it puts out to reach back? Thanks very much. This is NQ1U, John.
Yeah, they have these traveling waveguides. I know that was popular for years, I think. I think they still use them. And they're reliable. Voyager missions, they're still functioning, and they had them as well. They started off as around 25 watts or so, and they dropped down a little bit over time. But and they each had two. So, like, one was the backup. So, and anyway, they have a 10-foot dish. Yeah, they sent a 10-foot dish on this James Webb Space Telescope. And I think that was the second or third thing to unfurl when they were going into a deep space, which I was kind of worried about. You know, the solar panel came out right away. That was done automatically. And then mission control had got it, sent a signal to, move the antenna. The antenna was in a latch position, so that had to move and go to a proper location, and it all went fine. It was some kind of a motor, a big arm that moved it, and right away they started getting, I had the frequencies down, but usually it's in the 10 gig location. I think this is going to be a little different, though. Anyway, I'll find that out. But they do have that. Yeah, they have another antenna that they use right after launch, an omnidirectional S-band antenna. And this one has, the main throughput. They said there's going to be a tremendous amount of data that's going to be coming back from James Webb. You know, like terabytes of data over time. But if you go to their website, which is web.nasa.gov, I think it is, you bring that up, and they have all kinds of information. They'll tell you everything you want to know about this program. You know, how it got to where it is and all. It's doing good. After a month of flight, December 25th, Christmas Day, in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, the thing took off, and everything went well. All the stuff opened up properly. And now they're out in the, where they belong, the L2 location. And that's it. Anything else on that, John? Back to you. NQ1UWS1.
No, thanks. That was it. I was following the website that said Where's Web as it was going along. It was very nice. Great. I appreciate the work you're doing. It's really nice. Very great stuff to have. Thanks a lot. This is NQ1U.
Okay, very good. On one of the previous nets, I had the exact frequencies. But, not only their transmissions, but, what they receive at. They transmit information from the deep space network. That's pretty interesting. And, you can go to the deep space network and you can look at the different antennas that we have situated three main locations around the Earth. You have California, Goldstone, and then you have Madrid, Spain, and then you have Canberra, Australia. And each one has maybe three or four big antennas that are operational. And if you go to Deep Space Network, you can see which antenna is, talking to what particular satellite at a particular time. And when it's doing that, you just see that it looks like a wave coming off of the antenna. That means it's operational. So I look at, when I look at the James Webb Space Telescope, when it's talking to it, or when it's sending information back, most of the times it's on the, it's like Madrid or, never seems to be in California. We're always, when I'm looking at it, it's daytime. So I'm facing the sun, the United States, more or less in daylight, so that means it's the nighttime antennas that are talking to the James Webb, because that is 1 million miles away from us, so I mean, if I was looking at it at night, like now, if I look at it, I might see it, you know, being transmitted to a Goldstone. But usually I look at it in the daytime. And what I do is, it's always Madrid or Canberra or Australia. Anyway, we'll move on to another topic. This is WS2N. Astra is another rocket company. I keep talking about these different rocket companies. And Astra successfully orbited a spacecraft into orbit. They use their rocket. Runs on the same fuel that SpaceX uses. RP-1, really refined kerosene and liquid oxygen. But it's only about 45 feet tall. And they launched it out of Kodiak, Alaska. You know, we have a launch complex up there in Alaska. They tried four times. The fourth time they finally made it to orbit, the first three, you know, they had problems, you know, falling short, second engine stage not going, that type of thing. But the fourth one finally made it to orbit, and now they know that they got all the bugs worked out of it, and they'll be able to do it over and over again. So they have a contract with NASA. They're allowing them to launch from Launch Complex 46 in Florida next time. So they're down there now, set up their rocket. They tested they fired the engine. They have the system. But they'll light the engines, but it won't go anywhere. It's all tied down. Make sure everything's working. And I expect within a couple of weeks or so, they'll probably actually launch this rocket into orbit. They actually have a contract to put a small satellite. There's a couple of, I think there's four of them, four CubeSats that are going to be launched into orbit by Astra. And they use five of these they call them Delphin, that's the names of their engines. Five Delphin engines are, and then they have a second stage, which also burns kerosene and liquid oxygen. And that'll take the payload to orbit. And it's a similar design rocket that the company run by Peter Beck Rocket Lab. They launched the Electron rocket from New Zealand. They probably launched over 20 of these rockets so far. And they're successful, and they have a similar design. Most rockets that you see go up, they all have turbopumps. The turbopumps take these fluids, the liquid oxygen and liquid kerosene in this case, and they pump it into the chambers of the rocket engines. And to do that, they usually use pre-burners. In other words, small rocket engines, really. And they'll take the exhaust mat and spin up these turbines to, 100,000 RPM or whatever it is. I mean, they really move. But that's the system on how they spin up these turbo pumps. Rocket Lab, and now this company, Astra, has a different system to spin up these turbo pumps. They still spin them up to 100,000 RPM, but to do it, they have electric motors. And the electric motors are tied into these big honking and lithium-ion batteries. And it's been successful. I mean, they'll turn these things on, start pumping fluids, ignite the fluids with what these companies use is from the ground. They'll actually ignite it. They have their own igniters on the ground, and then this thing will take off. And that's the way these are designed. It's supposed to be a lot less expensive than this complicated pre-burner, you know, type of exhaust spinning turbine system. This electric system is supposed to be much more cheap. Now, these are not, right now, they're not recoverable vehicles, both of them. Although the Electron is coming close to becoming reusable. Electron has a system where the first stage, the second stages are not reusable at all. But the first stage, they have coming down through the atmosphere, and they have a power glider come open up above it. You know, instead of a parachute, it's power gliding, rectangular shaped thing. Opens up and guides it to a certain location near the water. A helicopter will eventually come by and grab the parachute and then take that load all the way to a boat, land it on a boat. The boat will take it to land and then reuse it. Electron has gotten to the point where the power sail opens up, it lands in the water, they pick it up that way. So they're getting close, but they're not there yet. This company has no intention of doing that, from what I read. The idea is to have the ability to launch these satellites as inexpensive as possible. For like, you know, a few million dollars a launch, you know, compared to $62 million for a Falcon 9 launch by Elon Musk with SpaceX. So we'll see how the small companies do. There's a lot of them out there. I keep trying to follow them. Now we have foreign ones, and you know, China eventually, they have some private companies that are involved with rocket launches as well. And I don't know, there's probably a dozen or so. Any questions or comments? WS1. Okay, let's see. One thing I wanted to talk about was this. Hold on one second. Okay, I've got to talk about this one launch that was supposed to go up last week by SpaceX. And they were going to launch an Italian radar system to about 400 miles in altitude. But due to weather, they canceled that, and then they canceled it for another day, and still hasn't gone up. They were supposed to launch like three different rockets within probably about 3 or 4 days. But because of the bad weather in Florida, this is what's happened. Let me drop it. Okay, yeah. Looks at the time. I got a little time. Last year, two Super Bowls ago, last Super Bowl. Last year they had a competition for going into space. SpaceX had this one guy, and he was going to hold this lottery. People were going to pay money to see if they can get one of the seats of four that was going to be the first launch of a private, 100% private, no real astronauts on board, mission to space, which eventually they did. I mean, last year four people got together, two women, two guys, and they were launched on a Dragon spacecraft, and they spent 3 days in space, higher than the International Space Station, and successfully deorbited, came back and landed. But one of the guys, his name is Chris Zabrowski, you know, he supposedly had won this ticket to do this, it was advertised on the Super Bowl, people poured all kinds of money. Turns out he bought about 50 tickets, and now the money was all going to be donated to St. June Hospital, which eventually it was. And, collectively, they were hoping to get like $200 million. I think they got nowhere near that. They were way short. Eventually, Elon Musk made up the difference, and St. Jude eventually did get